Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests. This evening, we have a special guest with us, Mr. Peter Buxton, and we haven't had Peter on for many years, probably 4 or 5, maybe 6 years ago. We did a series of programs with him. Went into the background of the Tuskegee study. Now, what was the Tuskegee story, and who worries about something that ran from 1931 to 1970, I guess 1932 to 1972? It was a public health study that was carried out with the full knowledge of doctors across the country, wherein a number of black men, over 400 of them, with syphilis, who entered into the study. They thought they were being entered into the study to be treated for their syphilis, but they were entered into the study not to be treated for their syphilis. And the idea was that when they died, they would be autopsied, and the scientists could then biopsy their bodies and see how the syphilis had ravaged them and how did it kill them. And the problem with the whole study was nobody seemed to be concerned about men, because it was done in the name of science. Well, you know, we see today a lot of programs being brought forward. We find all of our children are being vaccinated, actually, in the first day or so of birth in the nursery, for hepatitis B, which is not a problem for our children here in this country. There is no justification for inoculating 99 out of 100 of the children. Absolutely none. And by the time they become sexually active, of course, a lot of the immunization will have worn off and be ineffective. No reason to do it at all. It's a gigantic experiment. There's a new experiment coming up now where they want to vaccinate every little girl entering the sixth grade for human papillomavirus infection, because we really want to save their lives from cancer. And yet, if you look at the studies, there's not evidence that one life will be saved. And what about the complications that come from this? So they tell you there are none, but if you look at the studies, the way they ran them, they ran a certain group with the vaccination, then they ran the other group against the placebo. What was the placebo? It was the active toxic ingredient in the vaccine, and that's why they both have the same similar number of autoimmune diseases, because they were actually using the same adjuvant for the control, which of course you would never do. You could use saline, but they didn't want to do that. They wanted to rig the study. A massive experiment on the children of our nation. The same thing is true with the water fluoridation. They don't allow water fluoridation in Europe. They're then experimenting on the American people for over 55 years, with a massive experiment that's had disastrous effects on the intelligence and on the health of the American people, and they know that. But of course they don't want the people to know. Well, I think we have to understand Tuskegee, because we understood Tuskegee, we'd understand so much of what's going on today. And one man, you know, it's amazing, you know, you think, can one man make a difference? Well, I think our guest tonight can. In fact, he did. And although what he did many years ago, well over 35 years ago, really, in many respects, changed the thinking of an awful lot of people. What he did has been forgotten, but I think you'll find Peter Buxton's story fascinating. So please hang on. We'll be back in just a moment here with Mr. Peter Buxton to tell you the story of the Tuskegee experiment. Well, Peter, thanks very much for being with us this evening. How have you been?
Fine, Doctor. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. So I'd like you to sort of just tell how you got involved in this whole incredible story in your own words.
Well, in December of 1965, I was hired by the U.S. Public Health Service to be an interviewer investigator. I was trained for a couple of weeks, good training, but certainly not anything like what a doctor would have. But I knew a good deal about syphilis and other venereal diseases because I was going to be assigned to a clinic run by the city of San Francisco, but with a program operating in the clinic that was funded by the Public Health Service, the Federal Public Health Service, U.S. Department of Public Health, and Public Health Service, anyway. And so I would interview a certain number of the patients coming through who had either syphilis or gonorrhea, and sometimes I would just help the city people with what they were doing, and that was informing other people in the city that we had just treated someone with a disease and they needed to know about it, and they also needed to come in for treatment. Now, of course, we got a lot more people in that clinic with gonorrhea than with syphilis, and thank God for that. Syphilis, as you know, Doctor, is a deadly disease, and explaining it to your people here, I'd just like to say that all doctors knew that if you left syphilis untreated in a patient, that patient could suffer insanity, blindness, heart disease, death, and a number of terrible disabilities, painful disabilities as the years would go by. There were plenty of painful disabilities that came with gonorrhea, but most people came in for treatment because of those painful problems, with men particularly, an awful burning sensation on urination, and really bad. We got patients coming in who were desperate for treatment right now. And so that was what my daily work was like, and occasionally we would have an important case where we would think that somebody's wife might be pregnant, and here the husband was being treated in our clinic for syphilis.
I want you to hold that thought. We're going to be right back here as we bring our other stations right back on board.
Thank you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Peter was just telling us of his experience. He'd been hired by the U.S. Public Health Service to work there in San Francisco at the Public Health Clinic and to be interviewing people with venereal diseases. And, of course, he was waiting to get into law school at the time, weren't you, Peter?
No, not at that time.
All right.
That came a bit later, a few years later.
All right, fine. So, he had a job. He was working there at the clinic and certainly taking care of people with syphilis and gonorrhea. And, of course, one of the things that they were concerned about was somebody who had a venereal disease. Well, then, of course, you'd certainly want to tell their contacts. You'd want to tell their sexual partners or perhaps their family, their wife, that they had a venereal disease so that they could be treated, you know, if they had acquired it as well. So you pick up the story there.
Well, as I was starting to mention, one of the real problems that we had was occasionally a man would come in, sometimes shamefacedly, and ask for treatment, and we'd find out that he was married and that he had a wife, and then we might find out that the wife was pregnant. That was a real problem, because we knew that a pregnant woman who acquired syphilis could easily have a stillborn child. This was one of the big problems with syphilis, and perhaps even worse, the child might be born alive but with terrible deformities and problems in later life. So we would put a very high priority on reaching any women that we thought were pregnant. And we would work day and night to try to find them and bring them in immediately for treatment, not one more day.
And of course, this was the time when penicillin was readily available. Now there were effective treatments for syphilis, and we could cure syphilis with a series of shots. So this was really exciting, unlike as it had been perhaps in the 1930s, where there were no effective treatments for syphilis. But now there were effective treatments. We could prevent the passing on of the disease to the newborn and unborn. So go ahead.
So should we go back to the start?
Oh, go right ahead.
Pardon?
Go right ahead.
All right. So something very interesting happened in medicine in the late 1920s and then in the beginning in the 30s. There was a study done of statistics. It turned out there was a huge body of statistics in Norway, where at about the 1890s and around 1900, in that time period, Norway did not have good treatment for syphilis. Other countries had slightly better access to chemicals, and they had more use of arsenic treatments that were somewhat effective in treating syphilis. Being treated with arsenic was one of the first forms of chemotherapy, and it was scary stuff. As you know, arsenic is terribly poisonous, and it had to be administered very carefully. A heavy patient could take a little bigger dose. A small woman had to have a very carefully calculated, much smaller dose, and the doses had to be repeated, and there were a lot of side effects, including people losing hair and other unpleasant things happening, but the syphilis could be taken care of that way. Norway had a law requiring most syphilis patients to go into a locked clinic where, at that point, they did not have the treatment in the 1890s. While these patients couldn't leave, they did have doctors who attempted to help them with their problems as they developed and then as the patients died. And so careful medical records have been kept. Did people develop heart disease? How long had they had the disease before they got the heart problems? How long before they became insane or blind? And the very careful records still existed decades after the patients had died. Norwegian physicians did a study of those records, and they published the study to great welcome from the medical community. Oh, now we can figure some things out. If we can guess when the patient first got infected, then we know what the risk is, perhaps, for heart disease or insanity if they've had the disease 3 years, 6 years, 5 years, 10 years. And so it made a lot of news, and people in the U.S. Public Health Service welcomed a couple of these doctors over, and they had a big meeting. And the American doctors, some of them, came away thinking, oh, we should do something like that here in this country. Now, it might have been done on statistics, but instead, for a variety of reasons, the U.S. Public Health Service chose to do it on human beings as, if you will, guinea pigs. Shall I go on?
Go right ahead.
Well, something else was going on at the time. The 1920s were kind of a boom time for the United States. There was a good deal of money around, and the Public Health Service had some of it. And so they started doing really good things. They started trying to find out how much disease of really terrible sorts did we have in the United States. Not just syphilis, but tuberculosis, malaria, and a number of other things, including parasite diseases like ringworm and other worm-type diseases, hookworm being one of the big problems in the South. Because there was such poor sanitation, many people lived out in the country and didn't even have an outhouse. And the result of that was the spread of a lot of hookworm, because kids would run around all over the place, and They would pick up hookworms through their feet, and then as they grew to be teenagers and adults, they were, as you would know, Dr. Monteith, afflicted by the effects of this parasite, and they would be very tired all of the time and have a lot of complaints, and were not particularly good workers, and thus there's a body of jokes and bad interpretations of what was going on, and people would say, oh, well, you know, those folks are just lazy over there. Well, it had to do with the bad sanitation. But back to syphilis, there was a surgeon general at that time named Perrin, and he started a nationwide PR campaign. This is when the United States really led the world in public relations. And he started putting ads in newspapers and in major magazines around the country saying, syphilis is in your community. We need to find out who has it. Go in, if you are active sexually, go in to your doctor or come into special clinics. And they had special clinics set up in cities. And people could come in and at no charge be given a test for syphilis. This at the time was the Wasserman test. And there were all kinds of jokes about, don't be so positive, Dr. Wasserman, and all of that. And if you had a positive Wasserman test, probably you had syphilis. Not always, because there were false positives in the test. The later tests were better. And screening, if you will, nationwide screening started producing results. And the Public Health Service looked at the results, and they started finding certain areas had very little syphilis compared to others, and certain cities, and certain areas, and one in particular had a large amount of two kinds of syphilis. Fresh syphilis acquired a year or two or three before, or syphilis that came from birth. Because there was so much what's called endemic syphilis in the South, there were a lot of children who were born with the disease. I mentioned that many children were never born. They were born dead because the mother had the disease. But she kept trying and trying, and they had very little birth control then, and women would be pregnant, and this was back in the days when people commonly would have 8 or even 10 or 12 children. I, as a kid, remember neighbors who had a lot of children, and this was common in poor families particularly, where, again, there was no birth control. So a woman who had syphilis, although she might be pregnant 15 times, she might only have 3 or 4 children. And those children might grow up, and they would have problems in all of their life from birth. They would have a positive Wasserman test, as well as some of the problems of late syphilis in their late lives. And in fact, many of them lived a shorter lifespan than normal. Could I continue?
You're doing fine.
Well, so this was the situation, and then came the catastrophe of 1929 and the collapse of the stock market, the collapse of a lot of the revenue into the federal treasury, and so everything had to be cut back from the smallest county health department up to the public health service. All budgets were cut way back. Schools were cut back. People had to drop out of school and hunt desperately for a job, if they could find one, and a third or a quarter sometimes of the population would be out of work at any time during the Depression. So when the Public Health Service in 1931-32 started looking at the idea of doing a study of syphilis, what was the course of the disease from infection till either treatment or death, what happened to a human being when they were infected with syphilis? They started thinking, well, what should we do? And then it seemed by coincidence that a couple of hours' drive south of the headquarters of the Public Health Service community at that time, which was the Communicable Disease Center in Atlanta, Georgia.
I'm going to have to interrupt you there because I know you're going to tell us about a place called Tuskegee.
Right.
All right, you go right ahead.
So, 2 hours drive at that time, a little quicker now on better roads. You could leave the Communicable Disease Center laboratories.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mined supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a 4-tape or a 4-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer Iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that'll protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
You got headaches? Most headaches are caused by a structural weakness of blood vessels in the head, and the blood vessels are tending to balloon, causing a headache. The structural weakness is due to a deficiency. Correct the deficiency and the body will heal itself. I blended what I believed to be the missing nutrients in the right proportions, and the headaches went away. When they were gone, they stayed gone. I named it Headache Stay Gone. See HeadacheStayGone.com or call 800-327-0727 for more information or to place an order. I'll send you a bottle of Headache Stay Gone. Headache Stay Gone will cure your headaches and prevent them from coming back before you pay the bill. Headache Stay Gone has already cured the worst migraines I have ever heard of. Call 800-327-0727. All orders are shipped the same day. Call 800-327-0727. That's 800-327-0727.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Teary. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious-tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
There's an area called Tuskegee where there was a large number of people with syphilis. Of course, they could be treated. You'd have to get them into a clinic, and you could give them a slow intravenous arsenic treatment, and many of them were treated and cured. Some of them, of course, would not take their treatment because, of course, it was too hard to get there. They didn't like it. And so for that group, of course, it did not follow through with their treatment. They certainly were then, of course, going to be chronic carriers of the disease. You pick the story up there, Peter.
Yes, let me tell you that if you go down to Tuskegee today, you will find a small southern town, largely untouched, but things are changing bit by bit. If you go to the little town square in the middle of it, you'll find a statue of a Confederate soldier who had fought in the Civil War, a sort of a general statue, and it was a monument to the various little groups, not regiments, but small military groups that got together and marched off and fought in the Confederate Army in the Civil War. And around this small square, you'll see most of the major businesses of the town, and then a scattering of new things like garages or hamburger stands further out. And then as you go out toward the main highway, which is a couple of miles away, you'll pass a small airfield. And not much used anymore, but during World War II, it was the place where the Tuskegee Airmen were trained, and they had nothing, repeat, nothing to do with the Tuskegee study. They did not have syphilis. They were all, like all soldiers who went into World War II, every soldier was tested, black or white, officer or enlisted, Air Force or Army. They were tested for syphilis along with other diseases at the time that they were examined for induction. And this was the days of the draft, and we built a massive army. I think close to two or three million men, I think, just in the Army, let alone Navy, Marine Corps, Air Force, and all of that. So we had a huge military, and everybody was tested. The Tuskegee Airmen had nothing to do with syphilis, and they went off and earned a wonderful record in World War II. And then what else happened was, if you will, the dark side of what happened in Tuskegee, because already 10 years before the United States really got into World War II, we were attacked in December of 1941. By 1942, we were heavily involved in World War II. So by that time, the Tuskegee study had been fully 10 years in practice there in Tuskegee. What was done? The doctors in Atlanta at the Communicable Disease Center, now called the Centers for Disease Control, CDC, and it was changed to CDC, but different words. And they decided that they would like to find out what really happened in the disease syphilis if it was not treated. Now, there was a great debate at the time among physicians who had to regularly, day after day, treat patients with syphilis. And some doctors in some areas did not treat many black people because there were not many black people where they live. In other places, their whole practice might be concerned with black people. There was a growing number of black physicians. Some of them, many of them, trained in Tuskegee, where it's now Tuskegee University, was then a college. But they had the Andrew Hospital on the Tuskegee campus, and they produced not just doctors, but nurses and medical technicians there, and very good ones. And a strange collaboration began between Tuskegee, the Black College, and the Communicable Disease Center in Atlanta, Georgia. The doctors who actually started the Tuskegee study of untreated syphilis in the male Negro, that was the formal title of the study, by the way, those doctors at that time in 1932 were considered to be liberal doctors. How could that be? Well, they went out of their way to try to hire the um, doctors who were trained by Tuskegee, went out of their way to try to get them advanced training in hospitals on the East Coast.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in a moment.
Yeah.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this evening, Peter Buxton. We're going to be talking about one of the most really insidious, shameful stories in American history. And, of course, we're talking about the Tuskegee study. And so here we are. There are a lot of black doctors who have graduated from Tuskegee. And, of course, some of them are very bright people. And, of course, the liberal doctors are trying to help them out, feeling that the black man has been held down, and so they're going to try to get some of these blacks appointments in the better colleges for better training. So you pick the story up there, Peter.
Of course. At any rate, so going back to the idea of who were the doctors who started the Tuskegee study, they were very familiar with the problems of rural poverty and disease in the South, because the Communicable Disease Center was there in Atlanta. And for many reasons, the Public Health Service had been extending out as far as it could, as far as it had money, and the mandate from Congress to take care of the people of the United States. They were trying to take care of everyone. People knew that a disease like polio or tuberculosis might start with one case in the poorer part of town, but that person would get on a bus or go downtown to a store, and people would say, or use a drinking fountain, and there were regular panics with diseases when something like yellow fever or polio would hit. I, as a child, remember people being extremely worried about polio. I have friends to this day my age, I'm nearly 70, and I have friends today who can't swim because their mother didn't dare let them go to a swimming pool to learn how to swim because they were afraid the child, their son or daughter, would come home with polio, and many did. I have a friend younger than myself who has post-polio syndrome, and his life is a misery. He's sometimes a week at a time. You can't reach him on the phone because he's forced to take painkillers to deal with his problems. And then he'll have a few good days, and he'll call back, and, you know, you can be in touch again. But back to syphilis. What went on was the doctors of Tuskegee, meaning the doctors from the public, U.S. Public Health Service, went down to Tuskegee, and they were wondering, well, you know, we are still treating people nearby.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment with Peter Buxton. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Peter Buxton is giving us the story of how the Tuskegee syphilis story came about. And, of course, here we are. We're about 1932. Some of the patients are being treated for syphilis with intravenous arsenicals. There are a lot of poor people here. And, of course, you've got this great pool of people with syphilis, and there are those people out there saying, well, wouldn't it be nice if we really knew how this disease would progress if it wasn't treated? But you pick up the story there.
Sure. Well, there had been nationwide screening and nationwide attempts at treatment, but they didn't have penicillin then, and they had to use these arsenic compounds, dissolved arsenic, to treat people, like chemotherapy for syphilis. And so they were doing that to some degree in a city about 25 miles away from Tuskegee, and there were regularly people from the community being put on a bus to go away for 4 or 5 days to come back treated. They were kept in rooming houses, and they were brought in for 2 or 3 hours morning and perhaps also in the afternoon of needle in their arm, and drip, 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 they were getting this arsenic compound. So what happened, the doctors in the Atlanta, Georgia laboratories of the Communicable Disease Center But, well, since we're treating these people, since we have a base of operations, since we have a lot of people, way more than we can treat in this community, perhaps we can take some of these people and for 6 months just study them. Ask them very carefully, when did you notice your first symptom? And then they could figure out exactly how long these people had the disease. You can't do that with everyone, but you can do that with some. And so they were combing out typically only young men who had the disease. Why that? Well, it would have really been immoral to use women in this study, because obviously women of childbearing age should not have any additional risk of syphilis. So what was going on was these men were being combed out of the people who were headed towards treatment, and they were set aside for 6 months on the shelf, so to speak, while the doctors who had determined, oh, this guy is perfect for our little six-month study, he's had the disease for a year. We can tell that because he remembers his first symptom. And so they would set him aside for 6 months, and they would occasionally examine him. Different doctors would examine for different things. Heart specialists in particular were looking to see if early syphilis caused beginnings of heart disease. So they would question the patient very carefully, the untreated patient, and say, are you having any difficulty with your work? Meaning, can you work less now than you could a year or two ago before you were infected? And they basically found out, no, they weren't finding much heart disease in early syphilis. They were looking in people's eyes to see if they were finding the beginning of damage in their vision. Or also they were testing reflexes and things like that to see if there was any neural damage occurring from the disease. So different doctors were checking different things, and each individual patient had a file, and at the end of the 6 months, a study was found in which the doctors declared that they had discovered a gold mine of pathology. This is an infamous phrase that is mentioned in the great book that tells the origins and the history behind the study at Tuskegee, and that is the book Bad Blood by Dr. Jim Jones, who's an old friend of mine and in fact lives here in San Francisco, not awfully far away from where I live. He has since written a brilliant book on Dr. Kinsey, for which he got the second prize in the Pulitzer Prize Awards a few years ago. But back to the study. Well, I would just say this. If anyone wants to know the background of Tuskegee, just remember the book Bad Blood. There's another good book called Tuskegee's Truths. And in fact, if you look those two up, you're on, for instance, Amazon on the Internet, you will find other similar books, very good ones, and some of them kind of heavy, that will tell you about this. But the best one to start with is Bad Blood by Jim Jones.
In fact, we have a interview with Jim Jones, in our four-tape set on Tuskegee, which is a classic because it gives you the information you'll never get elsewhere. Dr. Jones, I'm indebted to him for a wonderful book, but you can write ahead.
Well, so what happened then, the doctors were going over their results from their quick six-month study. That's all they had money for was 6 months. And the doctors were talking among themselves there in Atlanta, and they said, my God, look what we've got here. What should we do? And there were doctors who could see clearly, opening up to them, the opportunity for their name to go down in medical history. And indeed, their names did go far down in medical history because they did not think through what they were doing. They could not think about the 1950s and 60s when the civil rights movement came. That was a surprise to educated and uneducated alike. in the south. It was something that was brewing for a long time, and when it came, it swept across the United States. So these men, these doctors in 1932 and 33, had no thought of civil rights. Some of them, in fact, had gone out of their way to extend favors, professional favors, to young black doctors or x-ray technicians or nurses, and employ them wherever possible. And that brings in a fascinating woman, a tragic story, a woman from really a tragedy in Greek history, a good woman who was used to a bad purpose. And that is Nurse Rivers. Her last name was Rivers, and she was a nurse. She was trained at Tuskegee. Very hard-working woman, came up from real poverty in the Depression. She actually had to quit nursing at one point and get the only kind of job that she could. She became a domestic, a houseworker, a maid for some local family for a year or two. And then an opportunity came along, and she was given a job working for the Communicable Disease Center in Atlanta, but not working in Atlanta, working down in Tuskegee. She was made the nurse in charge of the men of Tuskegee. It was her job to keep track of them, to tell them, to notify them, send them notifications in the mail where they could be reached by the mail, or go out in a car, a second-hand Ford that was bought by the U.S. Public Health Service for her, and she would drive out on the terrible country roads in the mud when it was raining, or in the dust when it was dry and hot, and she would notify the men working out in the fields, "Where's Bill? Where's Joe? I need to find him. He's got to come next Thursday into the clinic." And then, if there was no transportation, she would have to go out and pick some of them up, pack them into her car, and bring them to the clinic herself so they could be examined.
But I think what's important for our listeners to understand is the decision was made not to treat these men.
Yes.
And, of course, Nurse Rivers said it was to coordinate this whole thing. And, of course, it was all in the name of science. It was all in the name of being able to come up and write papers about the course of untreated syphilis. And after all, the treatment wasn't that good. I mean, some people, it was long, painful treatment. Some people wouldn't go through with it. So now there was a pool of people, and what they forgot is that they were human beings. They were simply, of course, part of a statistical analysis. They forgot that every human being is a unique creation, made in the image and likeness of God. And suddenly the doctors, playing God, were going to study them. And that's what it was all about, a study, the Tuskegee study. So pick the story up, Peter.
There is this infamous phrase today. In fact, I think there's a book, a couple of books perhaps, by the title of "For the Greater Good." Because this was something the doctors of the 1930s regularly did. They would sometimes omit treatment to watch what would happen in a certain patient, or they would have a small study here or a big study there that would delay treatment and maybe never treat. The Tuskegee study was not the only study of this sort. In fact, not the only one of regarding syphilis. But now there's something important to notice, and that is the numbers. 400 plus, I think 420 something men with syphilis were being studied. But over 200 men from the same community were also being studied, and they were clearly not infected. They had negative Wasserman tests, but they were enrolled in the same study as the, quote, uninfected control group. Now, there was a problem here and there, and by about 1938, when they were going down and checking on the men and doing some physical examinations, they discovered that a dozen or a couple of more, between 12 and 14, of the control group had acquired syphilis because of their social activities, we could say, and they had fresh cases of syphilis. syphilis, untreated, of course, because they had just been discovered, and using a bureaucratic device, they were simply moved to the other side of the ledger kept in Atlanta, the books, the records that kept track of the infected and the uninfected men in the study. And those 12 or 14 men were added into the group of infected men not to be treated. But not to be treated. There had been an earlier problem. And this is one of the scientific criticisms of the Tuskegee study. The doctors from Atlanta had to secure the cooperation of the Macon County, Alabama Board of Health, or health services such as they were in the Depression, and also the few doctors who were practicing private medicine in the area.
The Medical Society, right?
Medical Society, which was primarily white, a few black doctors, but mostly white at that time. And we need to keep our eye on the Medical Society because they can come back in the story in the 1960s. But they all signed off. The county medical facility, the people running the medical facilities for the county signed off on this study. They said, yeah, okay, go ahead and do this study and we'll kind of watch. But do we really have to have known syphilitics, known men, in their late 20s and early 30s, running around our community with untreated syphilis and not knowing that they have untreated syphilis? Can't you give them just a little bit of treatment so they're at least not infectious, we think? Okay, if we have to. So when the study was first begun, some treatments, some, how much? The records don't exist anymore. The letters between the doctors and the records from the Atlanta-based part of the operation don't really say who got how much treatment. They got some arsenic treatment, and they got a secondary treatment with bismuth, which was used in cooperation, and also they would be given an occasional jar of cream. Not like a hand cream or face cream or anything. It was basically Vaseline with a certain dosage of mercury in it. Well, here's another poison again. So we're treating with three poisons, arsenic, bismuth, and mercury. And these men were told, every night before you go to bed, smear your arms and chest with this cream. It's good for you. And so they were absorbing mercury through their skin. And people for centuries had known that syphilis could somewhat be treated a little bit with mercury. And in fact, there was an old saying, a historical saying, 200 or 300 years old now, one night with Venus, a lifetime with mercury. And that meant you would go to bed with someone and the next day you'd have syphilis. And for the rest of your life, the best thing you could do for your health would be to smear yourself with poisonous mercury. Or even, worse yet, take it in pills. That gets into a whole different story. But continuing back with where we were, not only did Tuskegee, then college, cooperate with the beginnings of the study, but also the local medical society and the county medical service signed on to it and understood what was going on.
And the black doctors, this is one of the most amazing things, the black doctors went along with it too.
Well, there are good and bad reasons for neglecting that part of the story. It is part of the history and it is a sadness of the condition at the time. And it gets even stranger, because I'll tell you a little story that isn't in the books. I was myself down at Tuskegee University a few years ago, and I met a very tall, very elegantly dressed gentleman, a retired physician from Tuskegee, a black physician from Tuskegee, a highly intelligent man trained in northern hospitals, and he told me a story that absolutely shocked me, that in the 1940s or 50s, I have to guess, I think late 40s, early 50s, he was doing his residency in a hospital in a northern city that had a lot of Polish immigrant workers in the, I don't know what, packing houses or whatever that were nearby, some of them who didn't speak very good English. And he told me, and this was interesting to me because I was leaving Atlanta the next day to go on to Europe, and I had to travel in Europe on business, and one of the places I was going was Poland. I said, what? You had Polish patients there? What was happening? Well, we at the time weren't treating them, and they had problems. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I would walk by a room where there might be four or five men in the room, and they'd call to me in Polish. And he said, there was this word that they used, and they repeated it over and over. And I carefully wrote down the word, and he would go in and try to help them because they were in pain. They had untreated syphilis, he told me. And I then went to Poland and asked a friend. I repeated the word to him. My Polish friend looked at me and said, that's the word for pain.
All right, we're going to be back in just a moment with our special guest, Peter Buxton. All right, Peter, pick the story up.
Well, to finish that little story, so Tuskegee is the giant tip of an enormous iceberg. And the whole story has to do about the terrible problem that confronts us today. As you pointed out, scandals are being mentioned in our newspapers this week about the papillomavirus inoculations that were scheduled to be given to preteen girls in certain cities, and there is a great debate. Some parents won't let their daughters have the vaccinations, and you pointed out certain problems with the testing of the vaccines and the statistics being used to argue in favor of these vaccinations. And we have terrible problems today. Oh, a year and a half ago, there was an issue in New York City with AIDS. There were a lot of infants in orphanages, children of crack addicts, women who would have a baby and abandon it and wander back into the streets never to be seen again. And these children not only were born with all of the problems of the crack that the mother had been using during her pregnancy, but they were also often infected with AIDS. And the question was, there were certain medications that were being tested at that time and beginning to show the possibility that they could be used in treating infants and young children. And the moral question came up, wait, these medications look like they're going to be good. Should we deny them to little children in our care just because we haven't finished the studies? And so a decision was made, well, look, here are a couple of these medications. Let's start trying them and keep records. And they did. And then, of course, doctors would move on to other things, and the study went on, and then it was terminated. And then people were looking for the records, and they couldn't find all of the records, and a terrible brouhaha exploded, and well, it might, in the African-American community. People said, this is another Tuskegee, and was it or wasn't it? It isn't as clear to me that it was, but it certainly brought up enormous issues that happen every day. And now I have to bring up the boring part, the really tedious part of what happened.
All right, fine. We're going to have to hold that. We're going to have to get into that the next hour. Our guest has been Peter Buxton. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and of course, Peter Buxton is giving you the introduction to the Tuskegee study, in which he played a key role, at least as far as the exposure of this study. By the time they got around to actually ending the Tuskegee study, close to 350 of the black men were dead, and many of them were mad and blind, and a terrible, terrible thing. 40 years that kept going. But you have to understand, they've done all sorts of very similar things, feeding our sometimes children in orphanages of the plutonium. If you don't believe, of course, they've done massive experiments on our military. They did that during the first Gulf War. If you haven't read the book, the Vaccine A, or got a 4-tape set on Vaccine A, over a third of those young men were ill by the time they got home. Over 80,000 of the original 695,000 men we sent off to the first Gulf War are now dead. Over 80,000 of them. And you've never heard that, of course. We couldn't let the American people know what's really going on, or that our entire population is being used for massive and macabre experiments would make Dr. Mengele, wife Gershom, rub his hands, his bony hands, in glee. People find it difficult to believe that there really are doctors who have a different worldview. Now, most doctors are good people. Most doctors are compassionate people. But I find that very often the people in the major universities, the people with so much education, they're so much smarter than the rest of us, have a different worldview. And if you've never seen my talk on planned population reduction, or the video that you need to get it, you need to read my pamphlet on the population control agenda monograph. Our 4-tape set on the population control gets into the outlawing of DDT, which was not outlawed because it was unsafe, but because it was saving so many human lives. And 33 years later, after DDT was banned, suddenly the World Health Organization said, "Oh, shucks, why, we made a terrible mistake. 100 million people dead," and I don't believe what they're lying to you. They say 1 million people die every year of malaria. It's 3 million people. 300 million, between 300 and 500 million every year contract malaria, and it decimates the impoverished parts of the world. And now, 33 years later, they say, "Oh, shucks, made a mistake." Like in Botswana, where 46% of the women, the pregnant women there, are HIV infected. A great experiment. It really has been very successful. And it is a genocidal program, because if it weren't a genocidal program, if it were a public health failure, they'd change the approach. But any effort to change the approach and try to stop the spread of the disease among the blacks in Botswana is being effectively blocked today. Until you understand what's going on, incidentally, those figures, 46%, we get them, we take the U.S. Commerce Department is studying very carefully the success of our policies in Africa, in Botswana. If you want the pages, you want the reports, you want to take them as I do, you can find out about it. But you can only understand what's going on by reading my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or by watching our video or DVD, Planned Population Reduction. And let me, of course, suggest we have a wonderful 4-tape set on the Tuskegee study. It's a classic. There's nothing quite like it. You need to understand Tuskegee to understand what's going on in the world today. And to understand and make any sense out of it, you have to understand there is a spiritual battle going on. A spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization, and is removed towards World War III, and it's coming in the not-too-distant future. Our carrier groups are now armed and ready there in the Persian Gulf. The Boxer Expeditionary Force with 8 ships and a large unit of Marines are there waiting to come ashore in the Gulf today. And most Americans have no idea what's going on, because the government has repeatedly said, "Why, we're not planning on going to war with Iran." But then, of course, they were saying that about Vietnam at the time of the Gulf of Tonkin, which incidentally never took place. It was all a fraud, and 58,000 Americans died for absolutely nothing. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for Radio Liberty. Our number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV. War. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest, Peter Buxton. We're talking about the Tuskegee study, and of course, Peter played a very important part in this story, but he's giving you the background of course, is what is leading up, and we're talking about what's happened in the 1930s when they decided they would have a large number of men, there were over 400, who were not being treated, and Nurse Rivers, a nice black woman, was, of course, very flattered, being hired by these white doctors, and her job was to keep track of all the men in the Tuskegee study. These men who were being told that they were being examined and treated, but of course they were not being treated, they were being followed so that they could die and be autopsied. And you might ask, how could that be going on? What would be going on in the minds of the doctors? But you must understand, it was all in the name of science. So, Peter, pick up the story.
Well, I'd like to say something in addition to what you just said. One of the things that you will find if you study the history of the Tuskegee experiment, it was, quote, an autopsy-oriented study, close quote. And in fact, they would refer to the death of a study participant. We would now call them a patient, but they weren't really patients because they weren't being treated. The participants would die, and that was called end point in the study. The real end point would have been, of course, when all of the men had died, and actually all of the men have now died of old age and other diseases. And, of course, there was a control group of people who did not have the disease, and they are all dead now, too. But some have wives still living, and many have large families. And so around Tuskegee, there's quite a large community interest in all of this, and that's a very complicated story in itself, what's going on in Tuskegee, what is the legacy. But I'd like to first mention two other things. Early on, you just now, a few minutes ago, mentioned the types of diseases going through Africa. And you were talking about how modern medical science is being brought to Africa. To me, the really fascinating study is that of the country of Chad. And there's not one American in 20 who can point to Chad on the map of Africa, but it has oil. And it's smack dab in the middle of Africa. And how do you lift oil up out of the ground and transfer thousands and thousands of tons of it to the markets of the West? And the answer is you have to use a 360-mile-long pipeline that crosses another country. But then you find there are two problems. One problem is the possibility of collapsing infrastructure in suddenly very important Chad, which has been ignored by everybody forever, until about 10 years ago when surveyors started saying there is a lot of oil in this country and it ought to be brought out, and the World Bank stepped in to try to stabilize the country, to try to bring in medical care so that at least in the cities and along the roads and in the infrastructure, the police, the administrative officials, the political aristocracy running the country would be able to keep things running, hopefully without an army. That became an issue. And the disease, of course, that they were most worried about was AIDS, which is, of course, sweeping through the countries of Africa and has been doing this for some time. The story is fascinating. If you just enter Chad and World Bank on Google, you will get a couple of evenings worth of reading that will tell you some very interesting things that might tie in with what you observed in Botswana. I would like to know more about what information you have, and we can, of course, exchange information by email. But let me continue with the boring part of what happened with Tuskegee.
All right, folks, we'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty with our special guest tonight, Peter Buxton, who lived this story for many years. Well, Peter picked the story up there.
What could possibly be boring about such a terrible story as what we've been going into? And that is what the U.S. government did about it. Now, we both know, and we've been discussing the different problems of medicine, let's say, for 100 years and more before the study began in 1932 in Tuskegee, Alabama. And there were all kinds of problems, and one of the problems that started showing up around the turn of the previous century, let's say, the problem started showing up around 1900. It actually existed long before that, but people started noticing it 1910. After World War One, people still noticed it. There were experiments going on in prisons, and a few doctors said, look, you shouldn't really be going in and experimenting on prisoners. They are really, you know, at your mercy. They kind of have to do what you want them to do, or you can go in and pay them 50 cents to take a shot or a treatment or have something smeared on them that may burn their skin and scar them for life, or all kinds of interesting things were done by dermatologists and communicable disease specialists, and various scandals would be written up by a local newspaper, and then it would be picked up by a national newspaper, and people would say, wait a minute, this has a bad smell about it. So by the time of the exposure of the Tuskegee study in 1972, what had happened was the government, then the administration, I believe of Mr. Nixon, was working quietly in the background. Oh, what should we do? Gee, at some point we're going to have to do something. And so little groups would meet from time to time in the administration and among the federal medical community, you know, the Communicable Disease Center in Atlanta and the hospitals around Washington, D.C., they would have these little meetings and they would discuss different diseases, different problems. They would discuss funding and they would say, gee, what are we going to have to do in the future? And various ideas were floated around. And when the bombshell went off, that black men by the hundred were being used as guinea pigs in Tuskegee, that galvanized the Washington bureaucracy, and they said, oh my God, we've got to scramble, yank something down off the shelf, and run to Congress and get funding for it. We've got to do something. We've got to look like we're doing something.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment with Peter Buxton. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Peter's just saying that certainly in the early 1970s, you know, under the Nixon administration, they were considering what to do about certain diseases. There were lots of little think tanks in Washington, D.C., but when suddenly the American people realized that they've been using blacks as guinea pigs, and remember, we'd just gone through the civil rights crisis, and we'd seen the President of the United States killed, his brother killed, and then Martin Luther King killed, and we'd had the civil rights marches, and there was a great deal of race consciousness. And then we found that for 40 years, hundreds of blacks had been intentionally allowed to die to reach an end point so they could be just autopsied. That was the whole idea, was let them die and autopsy them. And there were some people, the average human being, was outraged by that. And so the bureaucrats back in Washington, D.C. said, oh, well, my goodness, we've got to get the people. You know, they've got to trust us, you know, because we're from the government. And we wouldn't want them to be unhappy with, or to really realize our worldview is perhaps different than theirs. So go ahead, pick up the story, Peter.
Well, I must put in a slight correction, I think, and I am not a physician and you are, but I would say that if you had 100 men today, and theoretically, if they each came down with syphilis today, and you followed them for the rest of their lives untreated, you would find a few who would actually have a normal lifespan without too much problem. The bulk, the large percentage, of course, would either die or suffer heart disease, insanity, and blindness, or God knows what, the terrible neurological symptoms. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. The key thing was when the bombshell went off, the government had to look like it was doing something, so it came up with, actually it's an oxymoron, a bureaucratic solution to the problem. The bureaucratic solution is called institutional review boards. Everybody should be going to sleep at this point from just that name. Well, institutional review boards may be boring to most people, but they are a terrible pain in the neck to medical research. These are bureaucrats, some of whom may or may not have a medical degree or of one sort or another, but most of whom are just plain career bureaucrats, and they have been given a mandate by Congress to jump in between the doctors who are doing research and those people who may want to volunteer for a beneficial study. I myself once volunteered for such a study, but I had to take a trip overseas. I missed an appointment that I would have otherwise been able to attend, and I was dropped from the study. But it was a study that interested me, and there was a chance that I would learn some things and possibly even later on would have treatment for a condition that I then had and don't anymore. But anyway, it was of interest to me, and I volunteered for it. But this was very strictly run and very expensive and difficult and time-consuming, partly because of institutional review boards, which have not gone away, which have not gotten smaller. In fact, they've gotten larger, more intrusive, and like all federal bureaucracies, they are terribly jealous of what? Their jurisdiction. They want to expand and have expanded their jurisdiction. And I think this was written up recently in the New York Times. About 2 weeks ago, there was an article just on this. And so I don't want to go further with it because it really is boring and it is not the effective way of dealing with the problem. I can tell you how I think the problem should be dealt with.
Okay, go ahead. But I think we ought to get back to the story of
Let's take a break.
All right. Well, it's certainly if Peter wants to relax there for a couple of minutes.
No, that's okay. I can go on.
Then go right ahead.
Okay. Let's just say this. Let's say you, Dr. Stan, and I, and let's say some of your listeners would be interested in a disease, Alzheimer's or anything else. I'm almost 70 years old, and let's just say that I was concerned about it, and I heard that there was a study going to be done on Alzheimer's or any other disease you care to think about. And we were thinking about volunteering. Well, how would it be done most simply? And I'll tell you how. The difference between the medical knowledge of a person coming off the street and a doctor is, of course, enormous. You cannot level the playing field, except in a certain way that I'm going to describe. Let's say there are a group of a dozen doctors. They want to do a study. Let's say there are 100 of us who are potential people to be subjects of the study, and we're willing to do this if we're not mistreated, if we're treated right. Well, the way to do it is to take a small amount of the money that's going to be used in the study, and these studies are very expensive, and they have to have big funding, which generally means they have big pharmaceutical companies behind them often, and or the government. Anyway, so a small amount of money set aside, and one doctor and one lawyer be hired from outside the group in any way connected to the study. And if you, doctor, and I were, let's say, going to volunteer for this study, we would have the option, first, of going to a private physician, our physician, a stranger to us, but paid for by the study itself, and he or she, independently, would advise us, well, here's what the study is going to do, here's what it's going to be looking for, here are the drugs that may be used, and I'll tell you what I know about them, and you will either get that or a drug, or you will be given a placebo, and you won't be able to tell the difference. And, you know, the doctor will tell us everything about it. Then there could also be one lawyer hired, you know, 100 people, one lawyer. That can be done in a few weeks or a month. And you can go in, and in an hour, the lawyer can lay it out to you. Well, here are your legal rights. Here's what you will have to sign to participate in the study. And if you think something is going wrong, please come to me immediately, and I'll put a stop to it. And that is the real way to do it. Not that we should overnight fire a couple of thousand bureaucrats who right now are working away, sending reports to each other, and going to conferences where they discuss how they can rewrite their forms and their reports, and how they can get more jurisdiction, and how they can, quote, better serve the public. Rather than that, you could cut the cost of this institution that is impeding medical progress, and you would get a better humane result. But good luck in trying to sell that to Congress. They'll give you a fishy look, and they'll say, well, we're busy passing laws here and finding out about what to do about this war, and you know, write it all up to us and send it to one of our aides, and I will pretend we're thinking about it.
Well, Peter, let's just get back to how did you get involved with the Tuskegee problem?
Right. In 1966, I was a young investigator, interviewer, working for the Public Health Service, U.S. Public Health Service, and also I was getting a city mileage check. I got a federal paycheck, a city mileage check. I was working in a cooperative program between the feds and the city health department here in San Francisco. And one day, in our clinic down south of Market, I walked in with a sandwich to have my lunch, and there were three people sitting there in our coffee room, and there were two nurses and a senior public health service officer, very nice man, don't remember his name, and he was just finishing telling a story. And he said to these nurses, and they were listening very attentively, and he said, and the patient's family took him to a private physician who had a practice 20 miles away or so, and he didn't know about the Tuskegee study, and the reason the family brought him in is he was insane. He was plainly insane. He'd been getting worse and worse over a year or two, and they didn't know what to do anymore, so they saved up their money and they took him to a private physician. The physician did the regular blood test and immediately diagnosed this man as having late untreated syphilis, and that was clearly the cause of the insanity, you know, very plain to the doctor. And so the doctor, following the guidelines of the Public Health Service, immediately treated this patient with penicillin. And the next thing the doctor knew, a week or two later, he got the local county health department down his throat, and the doctors from Atlanta at the CDC, Communicable Disease Center in Atlanta, they jumped all over him and they said, see here, you have spoiled one of our volunteers. What? Spoiled volunteer? What? And they explained to him about the study, and he had no idea about that, and so they graciously let him off the hook. They might have been able to take away his medical license if they had wanted to. I don't know. It never apparently came to that. Well, anyway, so he finished the story. The two nurses went back to work, and I said, wait a minute. Here I am with my sandwich getting ready to have lunch. And he was finishing his coffee, and he said, look, I'll tell you the whole story. And he did. He went to the beginning, told me about the study. And I had a requirement to write a paper, and I'll tell you about that in a moment.
All right, fine. Well, Chris, here we are now. We're almost, 35 years, 33 years or so into the end of this study. It's been going on for 33 years, and because these men are, and everything is being done to keep them from being treated. I mean, their names are circulated across the country, and they're being tracked by the government. And volunteers, they didn't volunteer for anything. They thought they were being treated, most of them did, and everything was being done to block their treatment here in America. Well, Peter picked this story up from there.
Well, what did the men volunteer for? You're quite right, Doctor. They didn't volunteer. What happened when they were picked up in these screening studies with blood tests of the Wasserman test, now called the VDRL test, and much improved over the Wasserman test, when they were picked up, they were told, you have bad blood, which already was a common term in the South and elsewhere, and it didn't just mean a person had a positive Wasserman test for syphilis. It also had vague meanings about people who were depressed or they had tired blood, and there were all kinds of vague terms, but bad blood got to be a term of art in the Tuskegee study, and the men were regularly told, oh yes, yes, we diagnosed you, yeah, you have a problem, and we'll take care of you. And indeed, if a man broke his leg, the study might have arranged to have him treated. They didn't want him to die of an infection secondary to a broken leg, because that would mean they'd have to autopsy him 20 years too soon, as far as they were concerned. And so they did little treatment here and there. Nurse Rivers would go around to a community, and the men would come to her, and they were very friendly, and they looked up to her, and she would have, in the back of her car, she would have various medications, some of them which were basically a liquid form of aspirin or other things, pink medicine. She'd give out a bottle of pink medicine to men who had aches and pains, which may have been totally unrelated to syphilis. They might have had rheumatism or who knows, whatever they called it, or minor infections that could have turned into gangrene or whatever. She would treat whatever she could, and she was very good and well-trained at it. And so she was highly respected, and in fact, sad to say, the families of the men of Tuskegee would often complain, and they'd say, get me in that study. I want to see a doctor. I want to be examined. I want to be treated. I want a bottle of pink medicine like you get for nothing. And from time to time, a man would die. And Nurse Rivers would carefully make sure that as the man was getting sicker and sicker, she would visit the family and sympathize with them and say, toward the end, she could tell when the man was nearly gone, and she'd say, I can bring him into the hospital and you can visit him there and he'll be well taken care of there. And that indeed was done, but he was a little better taken care of than the family understood. When the man would die, he would be taken down into the pathology lab and put on a slab and autopsy by one of the doctors working there in the Tuskegee College, as it then was, Tuskegee College Hospital, Andrew Hospital, and a proper autopsy would be done. That was the key. Occasionally, Nurse Rivers, I believe, would find that the patient had already died a week before and was already buried and there was nothing she could do, and she would just have to cross that name off her list, and the doctors in Atlanta would be terribly disappointed that they missed an end point autopsy. They missed the final real results that they were looking for. So that's how the study was working. Well, I found out about it, and in graduate school, I had studied German history. I happened to speak German, and I...
Hold that thought, Peter.
Yeah.
All right, Peter is just telling us that he'd found out about the Tuskegee study, and of course he had studied German history in college. He spoke German, so pick the story up.
Well, in college, I had studied World War II. I was quite interested in it, and having been born in Europe and having fled Europe in 1938 as an infant with my parents, I was 11 months old when I came to this country, I was very interested in World War II. I wanted to understand it. And as part of my study in college, I became very familiar with the Nuremberg war crimes proceedings and had done some reading about the various different medical experiments that had been punished by the Nuremberg court and the various different people who had carried out these experiments and fallen into the hands of the British, French, or American armies. The Russians generally took care of matters their own way, but they, of course, participated in the Nuremberg trials, and I knew about those trials. And what I did when I heard this story about the insane man being treated with for his insanity and his syphilis with penicillin, and the doctor getting in trouble for it, I was shocked. I thought, this shouldn't be happening. What is this? And we were working very hard, and we were going out into tough, hard neighborhoods to find people and bring them in for treatment. We didn't carry a badge. We didn't carry a gun. We just went out there with a business card, and some three or four tough guys would come up, and they'd say, who are you? And you'd hand them a card, and you'd say, I'm from the health department. I'm looking for so-and-so. And the next thing you know, those guys would be helping you find this person. So we were doing good work, and I thought, this doesn't sound like what I want to be associated with. This isn't like what we're doing here in San Francisco. So I had to write a paper as a regular part of my job, I don't know, every 3 months or whatever. And I had one coming up, and I thought, oh, well, this is simple. We call Atlanta all the time for business, and I can make one of those calls and take care of the ordinary paper things we've got to do over the phone, you know, preparing things, you know, comparing notes and having things sent to us. And I'll ask if there's any material on these studies at Atlanta. Well, I finished the regular things I did on this phone call, and then I said, hey, what's this about some study you've got in a place called Tuskegee? And the guy at the other end said, oh, yeah, I can send you a whole batch of information. Great, send it to me. So he did. And to my amazement, I got a big batch, a big brown manila envelope full of studies, the big studies that had been done every 10 years, and little studies, and various papers that had been written by individual doctors. And I went through this, and I thought, I can't believe this. There are words jumping off these pages at me, like the words that jumped off the pages of the Nuremberg proceedings. And so what I did, I wrote a paper that was just excerpts from the Nuremberg proceedings and excerpts from this material that I got, with a few little introductory words here and there, and a final conclusion at the end. And I handed that in to my boss, which somewhat horrified him. And then I did something else, because I didn't think that was enough. I sent a personal letter as a taxpayer and a citizen to my boss's boss, the head of the whole shebang of the venereal disease branch of the Public Health Service, a Dr. Brown, who we thought of as the big cheese. Hey, his signature was on our checks, you know, when we got paid. And we all kind of looked up to Atlanta, and that was headquarters, and he was one of the people who ran Atlanta and the CDC. And so I sent him a letter saying, basically, Dear Dr. Brown, I understand you have a study in Tuskegee of untreated syphilis in the Negro male, close quote, that's the title of the study, and that these men do not know they have syphilis and do not know that they're not being treated. And I would like to see that these men be treated and this study be terminated. And there are good reasons for this. The civil rights movement is going on right now, and the explosion that would follow the disclosure of such a thing might damage other good programs and good work that's being done by the Public Health Service. And that was the gist of what I wrote. I think the letter is either pictured or quoted in Dr. Jones' book. At any rate, the reaction to that was silence. Apparently, Dr. Brown read the letter and was basically confused. What? Who is this person? Why is he writing me? And what should I do about it? And he showed it to a few of his colleagues. And somebody suggested, well, you know, Christmas is coming up, and there's a bureaucrat here who's going back to Berkeley, where his daughter lives, and he's going to visit for Christmas, and he can just pop over across to San Francisco and interview this guy, me, and find out what this is all about. And I knew this man, and he was an older gentleman just about to retire. And he
left off. We'll be right back in just a moment. Hello, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Peter Buxton. And Chris, he was telling us the story of Tuskegee. And what's really has always bothered me is the people back at the Centers for Disease Control didn't know that they were doing anything wrong. They had no concept that there was something immoral about allowing these black men to go mad, to go blind, to become crippled, and to die. So pick the story up there.
Well, doctor, this kindly bureaucrat, I think he was he was about 60 at the time, ready to retire, getting ready, and he was a nice man, but he was confused too, and he said, "Well, Dr. Brown told me to ask you, why did you send him that letter?" And he had a notepad there, and I explained to him in great detail, and he looked more and more confused, and he wrote notes, and he quoted things I said, and he scratched his head, and he said, "Well, okay, I'm going back in a few days, and I'll tell Dr. Brown." And so there was more silence. Nothing happened. And a couple of weeks later, out of nowhere, came orders that I would attend a meeting at CDC headquarters in Atlanta. There was going to be a conference. Doctors from around the country and a few foreign doctors would come, and they would discuss various different diseases. And I thought I was being invited. Instead, I was being commanded to be in attendance there, not at the conference, but nearby, and available to be lectured, as happened at the end of the conference. I got to sit in a few parts of the conference, and it was very interesting. And at the end, at about 4 o'clock, I was told to be ready to meet with some people, and I was waiting there in the lobby and picked up by a half a dozen very serious men in suits. Dr. Brown turned out to be a mousy little bureaucrat and a physician, balding, and sort of embarrassed by the whole thing. And he said, "You're Mr. Buxton?" "Yes, I am. Please come with me. Come with us." And there were a couple of people glaring at me, kind of figuring out, who is this guy? Some long-haired hippie? Well, no, I wasn't. I didn't have long hair. And I was wearing a jacket and tie. And so we went down a long hallway into a meeting room with a long wooden table. Probably it would hold 20 or more people. And at one end of the room was the flag of the United States, and on the opposite side of the end of the room, the flag of the U.S. Public Health Service. And those bureaucrats gathered around that end of the table and sat down, and I sat partway down the table.
All right, you hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Peter is telling what happened after he had written a letter to the CDC and then been interviewed by somebody from the CDC because they didn't understand why he was concerned about the Tuskegee study and the plan, of course, to allow, really basically, to kill all these blacks. And so then he gets called ordered to go back to the CDC. He's taken into a meeting hall I've read the description of this from Dr. Jones' book, this long table, and here are all the people, the three or four of them up at the other end of the room, and he's at the other end of the room, and he's just a technician working in the Public Health Service in San Francisco. And here are the leaders of the Centers for Disease Control, the key bureaucrats in your governments, you know, working for your government, who have this scientific study that is going to advance the cause of science, and here's this puny little individual who's questioning them, and he's not even a physician. So you pick up the story there.
I will, doctor. One slight point. The doctors of Tuskegee were not trying to kill the so-called volunteers. They were trying to study them over whatever life they had left when they had syphilis, and of course the uninfected controls did not have syphilis, and they were being watched too to make sure that there was no confusion of some other disease that snuck in and maybe affected both groups. So I was there in that room, the little guy at the wrong end of the table, and suddenly one of the men stood up as soon as the door had shut. And these were, I think, about half and half, three doctors about and three high-level bureaucrats, all looking at me, and this one doctor was just boiling over with rage. He had read my letter, and he was furious. And he started out with, "See here, young man, we're getting great information here, medical data that we are using to save lives already today. This is helping us diagnose people to determine if a person has late syphilis or second stage syphilis. We are sharpening up our diagnostic abilities. Don't you understand this? Weren't you trained? How can you dare to send such a letter?" And he blistered my ear for 3 or 4 minutes. And when he felt better, finished, he sat down, and they all waited for me to apologize and to beg to keep my job. Instead, I opened up my papers and I said, "Well, doctor, I think I should read you some things from your own reports." And I started reading some of the quotations that I had used in the paper that I had prepared for my boss. And I got to one part, and it said, "Without the suasion," in other words, like persuasion, "but without the suasion of free transportation, free hot meals, and free treatment for other diseases, it would have been impossible to secure the cooperation of the volunteers." So these guys are volunteers, and you have to bring them in and feed them and treat them for other diseases, or they wouldn't volunteer. And then I went on, and I made the comparisons, and I pulled one or two quotes out from the Nuremberg War Crimes proceedings. And these couple of bureaucrats and several doctors all had horrified looks on their faces. They were all looking at each other. "Oh, my God, we've made a mistake." And it wasn't the mistake that I thought. They looked at each other and started talking, and I heard them say, "Oh, my God." And at one point, I had read something, and this doctor who had been chewing me out suddenly jumped to his feet. He said, wait a minute, let me see that. "I didn't write that. That must have been written by one of my colleagues." So they were looking at each other, and they'd finished with me. They didn't care about me anymore. I was just, to be dismissed and forgotten about. "Go away, go back to work. We're going to ignore you. We have a problem we've got to take care of. We weren't careful about what we put in our reports. We weren't careful about our protocol in managing, or protocols in managing our study. We have to clean up the study. We have to clean up our act, and we've got to produce some new reports. We can't have this sort of thing going on. This could cause us a lot of trouble. Just you go away and go back to San Francisco. We'll forget about you, but we have work to do." So they ignored me. And I waited some months, and I eventually wrote, before a year had passed, I wrote to Dr. Brown and said, "Dear Dr. Brown, I'm still working for you. And I'd like to know what has happened with the Tuskegee study." And he basically said, "Don't worry, we're taking care of it, and we are going to empanel a blue ribbon commission," meaning they got about 15 doctors who had worked on the study and one doctor who had not worked on the study, and they all were paid a government mileage check, and they all came to a conference. They all discussed the Tuskegee study, and they were saying, "Well, how are we going to sanitize this thing? How are we going to clean it up and make it work into the future, because it's a good study and we want to keep it going?" And they did that, and that was the work of the Blue Ribbon Commission.
Well, wasn't there one member of the Blue Ribbon Commission who said, "This is immoral"?
Absolutely, and you can see him if you can find the old tape recording, or if they have a CDC of it, just off the Harvard campus. I can't think of the television station's name, but it's a nationally known television station, and they did a piece on Tuskegee, and he was interviewed right after I was interviewed for the piece that they did. And he and I met, and we briefly spoke about it, and yes, we were on the same side, but they didn't listen to him either.
But there's only one man of this whole Blue Ribbon Commission who said it's wrong.
Yeah.
And all the rest of them said it's perfectly all right.
Well, then comes the death list. They said not only were we careless in writing up our studies, but we haven't put enough effort into, and we have more money now, we weren't putting enough effort into keeping track of these men. We're going to send Nurse Rivers out to do a real scouring of the neighborhood and try to find as many as she can. And we know a lot of them left the South and went up to Chicago and New York and other places for jobs. And maybe we can find them by contacting their relatives and bring them back under surveillance, under our care, and, you know, care for the study. And so that was done, and they found some people who had been lost, and they started examining them and doing things. But then they put together this list, and they had an infamous meeting with the doctors, the private physicians who practiced around Tuskegee, the local medical society, which at that point was mostly black doctors with a couple of older, about to retire, white doctors. And they met, and they were presented with this list that I call a death list. And they were told, Doctor, all of you, here's your copy of our list as best we can manage it, of everybody who is in our study, and we would like you to know that if any of these men come in, let's say a man, and these are my words, not theirs, I'm not sure of what was said, no records were kept of exactly what was said, but there are a number of doctors still alive who know of the meeting because they were there. And this gets to be important in politics, strangely enough. What happened, they handed out this list and they said, what you should do with this list is this. Have your secretary watch for these men, and if one of them comes in, let's say with pneumonia, please do not give this person antibiotics without immediately contacting the local people in the county health department, and they will contact us at CDC, and we will perhaps authorize you to go ahead and give this person life-saving penicillin, but you know, we want to know about it before you do it. Perhaps we'd want to take a blood test or something like that before you do. I don't know exactly what protocol they were following. But the death list was handed out. Now, why is this important? Well, it gets to be important because there was a black doctor who at one point was nominated by Bill Clinton to replace Surgeon General Jocelyn Elders, who was being pushed out of office because she had become an embarrassment, and that's a complete different story. But Jocelyn Elders had to go, and somebody new had to come in for political reasons. And this doctor, whose name may come to me in a moment, can't think of it right now. Anyway, he was scheduled to be the next Surgeon General, and it turned out that it was said that he had attended that meeting, and he had taken home with him a copy of the death list. Again, that's my term for the list of the men of Tuskegee. And he said, I was not at that meeting. I was never there. I never got that list. I didn't know anything about Tuskegee until 1972 when it became public and, you know, this bombshell article that was on the front page of the New York Times. And the then president of the Medical Association, a black doctor, well-known and respected in the community, said, yes, you were. You sat right next to me. You were there. I remember. And the two of them just flat out disagreed, 180 degrees, no, yes, no. Well, anyway, it wasn't settled, but it was settled politically. Bill Clinton turned his back on that doctor, and he got someone else. And on the day that Bill Clinton made the apology for the Tuskegee study, I was, I think, the only Republican invited to the White House on that day. And who did I sit next to, purely by accident? The doctor who did not become the Surgeon General of the United States. And we introduced ourselves to each other. He sort of looked puzzled and sort of like, who are you and why are you here? And I said, oh, I had something to do with the study. And I guess later he found out who I was, and I'd never seen him again. And, you know, I'd like to sit down and talk to him sometime, but there was no time at that time. And a really, truly historical event occurred when Bill Clinton made the apology that any president would have and should have, had it occurred, had the exposure and the question come up at the same time, they didn't. The idea of an apology didn't come up until years later. And the idea, I think, came from a white professor at the University of Virginia, a very fine man. I met him once at a meeting in Tuskegee, and that's a different story.
Okay, well, anyway, then, of course, they pass up the death list, and so they're really trying to get hold of all these people so they can prevent them from being treated.
Well, prevent is not quite the operative word.
All right. Monitor their treatment?
Pardon?
Monitor their treatment?
They wanted to insert themselves between the patient and his doctor. That's exactly what they were looking to do. And I cannot really carefully answer your question because the protocols were lost. Jim Jones, the man, the doctor, the professor, PhD doctor, who wrote the book Bad Blood, was the man, as a young graduate student, who discovered the missing archives of Tuskegee. You should know that when the bombshell went off and the public was outraged, the men of Tuskegee started coming in to a local black attorney named Fred Gray, a very fine man who came and gave a speech here in San Francisco about 4 months ago. And he got these men coming in, and they said, you should represent us. Here, look at this article in the local newspaper. And it was all over the local newspapers, of course. And so he did, and he sued on behalf of those men. And the Department of Justice of the United States of America was pounding him into the ground. They said, you don't have any proof. You know, yes, there was a study, but how can you prove that this was done or that was said? You don't have any documents at all. And he didn't. And he, you know, asked people, well, do you have any paperwork? And a few of them brought in something really pathetic. At the end of 25 years of the study, each man got a letter of thanks, basically a simple printed form saying, thank you, and the number 25 in a circle, big circle, thank you for 25 years of participation in the Tuskegee study. And with that little document came a check for $25. And a few of them brought those in, and he had that, and he had a few other things, and he had the statements of the men. But that wasn't enough for the court to allow the damages. And Fred Gray, the attorney for these men, was about to lose his case when he got a phone call from this young man, Jim Jones, who wrote the book Bad Blood, and he said, Mr. Gray, I know where there is information you need to have, and it's just up the road in Atlanta, because he had found 40 boxes, cartons, cardboard cartons, full of documents related to the Tuskegee study, and that was the key that turned the lock in the Justice Department, and suddenly the case was settled for not an awful lot of money, as I remember, between $1 and $1.5 million plus lifetime medical care, proper medical care, supervised by a black physician who knew the difference between right and wrong. He's a friend of mine now, retired, lives in Atlanta. And lifetime care for close members of their family basically was part of the agreement. And so some good came out of a lot of bad.
Well, of course, what happened after they had this, the meeting and the death list was passed out, and you were basically still trying to get something done, and you would actually, you got hold of somebody from one of the newspapers, didn't you?
Oh, I went around for more than 6 years trying to get people to pay attention. Whenever I'd bump into somebody who worked in the newspaper or was a reporter, I'd say, hey, let me tell you about something. And I particularly remember two reporters from the San Francisco Chronicle. I sat opposite them at a dinner. I don't know, there were, you know, a number of people. Somebody was having a party or something. And, hey, you guys are reporters. Yeah, we work for the Chronicle. Hey, let me tell you about something. And within 30 seconds, you know, what? Alabama? What? Syphilis? You know, untreated syphilis, their eyes glazed over, and they basically said, hey, pal, look, we got to write the news every day. This isn't news. This is some story. Look, write it up yourself sometime and show it to us or send it to us. Or, you know, don't bother us with this. With this, because we have to deal with it all the time. We're not really interested. And I talk to law professors, and that's a whole story in itself. And I talked to a lot of people, and then one day I was with a few friends at we finished dinner, I think, and I mentioned to one friend who was part of our little group we ran around with, and she had a few months before been hired by the Associated Press as a junior reporter and was working her way up. She's now the senior foreign correspondent at the United Nations for the Associated Press. She was working for the AP at that time. And the second time I told her about the Tuskegee study, all of a sudden she perked up and she said, "What? This is going on and you have papers about this, paperwork on it?" Yeah. Well, can I see the papers? I wish you'd look at them. So
well, that thought will be right back in just a moment.
Good.
All right, Peter, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the story.
Okay, so my friend took the paperwork that I had, copied it, showed it to her boss, and her boss said, "You're too junior, you can't write this up. You have to send this whole story to somebody in New York, somebody senior, they'll take care of it." She knew a woman there, she sent it to that woman, who couldn't open the letter for the package of papers for a few days because a big story had broken and she had to work on that. So 3 or 4 days later, she opened it up and said, "Oh my God, what's this?" She made a few phone calls, wrote her article, and got a byline, her name, on the front page of the New York Times. And she set off the bombshell and she got a Pulitzer Prize nomination, not the prize, nomination for investigative reporting, and all she had done was open her mail. But my friend eventually did get some professional recognition for what she had done. And what happened was Congress and the administration and the bureaucracy of the Public Health Service went into a panic, and various things came out of it. Two major studies were done, and big meetings were held. And, oh, do I have fascinating stories of going to Washington and testifying in Washington. And testifying at the very moment when Haldeman, Ehrlichman, and Dean resigned and suddenly everything stopped, the world stopped for 30 seconds and then it restarted. And I was sitting there with my mouth open, not able to speak. I had to stop, and then somebody named Ted Kennedy apologized to me and said, "I'm sorry, sir, please continue." And I finished my testimony, and I sat down, and the woman sitting next to me whispered in my ear, "Haldeman, Ehrlichman, and Dean have just resigned." I didn't know what had happened. I was, you know, sitting at a big desk, a big table again, a government table with other people listening to what I was saying. It was a fascinating experience.
Well, maybe we can get you back on some evening. I would love to hear the rest of the story here, but our guest this evening has been Peter Buxton. The man, of course, who blew the whistle on the Tuskegee story. Was certainly one of the most macabre instances, stories of our time. I would like to suggest that it is not the only story, but is one of the biggest ones, the best documented ones, and the one, of course, that was such an embarrassment, and eventually, of course, why there were some changes made. But nothing has changed as far as the attitude of the people behind the scenes. And to this very day, I've talked to people in the U.S. Public Health Service who justify this as a very noble and worthwhile experience because it was done in the name of science. Peter, thank you so much for being with us. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you, Doctor.
I'd love to get the rest of the story some other evening.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I hope you've enjoyed our evening with Peter Buxton. And of course, there's much more to this story. But what it's really all about is man's inhumanity to man. And believe me, there are lots of people in Washington, D.C. who are exactly the same. The FDA is releasing drugs that never should be released. The statin drug scam is simply just that. If you look at the scientific studies, and how much harm is it doing to the people? A massive experiment, a very profitable one for the drug companies. Oh, they knew that they were going to kill hundreds of thousands of people with Vioxx. They knew it was a dangerous drug. They knew it probably already killed 60 to 100,000 people, at least they had heart attacks or strokes, and of course they were going to continue that drug, and they would still be on the market today, had it not been for one man, David Graham, who worked for the Federal Drug Administration, who risked everything to bring out the truth, as Peter Buxton did in the story of Tuskegee. Because you cannot understand anything going on today unless you understand there are people who have a different worldview. You need to get our 4-tape set on the Tuskegee study. You may very well want to think about getting our 4-tape set on population control. My talk on planned population reduction. My talk on genocide. My talk, the story of the New Order of the Barbarians, which is really one of the most amazing 4-tape sets you'll ever hear, because it is the discussion by Dr. Dunnigan of a speech was given in 1969 by Dr. Richard Day, who was the medical director of Planned Parenthood, telling about the plan to withhold treatments for cancer, to keep them locked up, to create new diseases that would kill millions of people, and of course to certainly push this idea of population control, because there were too many people in the world, they were going to have to die of something, they might just as well die of cancer. If you go to our website at RadioLiberty.com and pull down our material, you'll be able to better understand what's going on. But behind all of this, and the only explanation, is laid out in my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness. Because there really are people who look at the world differently than you and I do. Because they worship a different God. Well, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like more information, if you'd like a free catalog, if you'd like to get a free copy of one of our newsletters on vaccines, a vaccination program has done more harm. 1 in 6 American children has a neurodevelopmental abnormality. About 1 in 6 American children has asthma. Why? We don't see this in other countries where they don't have the vaccines. The Amish children don't have autism because they don't allow their children to be vaccinated. They don't have the rates of asthma that our children do. They don't have the rates of juvenile diabetes. What's going on? A massive experiment, ladies and gentlemen, by people who have a different worldview. And, of course, these are the people who foment wars and revolutions, and they relish in suffering and inhumanity. And until you understand that there really are people who look at the world through different lens, you cannot understand so much of what's going on today, or what the future holds. And so we hope many of you will certainly get our material from Radio Liberty, my talk on the hidden agenda, my talk on Iraq, the untold story, my talk on sustainable development. All of these fit together into a common mosaic. And so again, our number 1-800-544-8927, our webpage, RadioLiberty.com. Please encourage people to listen to our programs. They're available free of charge on the Internet, 5 hours a day, 3 hours a day at Radio Liberty, or archived and available on MP3. And then, of course, we do hope many of you out there will give serious thought to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do, 5 hours every day, and then again on the weekend. Please pray for America, pray for revival, pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.
Tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.